Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Engineering remains a male-dominated field. In 2001, just 20% of the graduate students in engineering were women, and the numbers are even worse in the job market. Just 11% of the engineering workforce in 2003 were women, and they earn less than their male counterparts. But their history in the engineering field is rich. During World War II, there were the Curtis Wright Aeronautical Engineering Cadets, 918 young women who received advanced engineering training at seven top-notch universities and then did the work of Curtis Wright Airplane Company engineers who had been called off to war. Later on, we'll delve into the current challenges and opportunities for women in engineering, but first we'll learn more about the Curtis Wright Engineering Cadets. John V. Lenthy is a poet, performer, and educator, and author of Flying Into Yesterday, My Search for the Curtis Wright Aeronautical Engineering Cadets. Welcome to the show, John V.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Just to let our listeners know, there will be a book signing with John V. Lenthy and an opportunity to meet the Curtis Wright Cadets Thursday night at the Upper Arlington Public Library. We'll post a link for the event on our website at WOSU.org if you have any other questions. John V., your own mother inspired this story. Can you tell us about her role in it and how you were inspired by that?
Well, I heard about that she'd gone to Purdue and that she'd worked in Columbus at some place named Curtis Wright. But she never really talked about the work. She only talked about these wonderful friends she made and the good times she had. And I didn't really understand what aeronautical engineering could possibly have to do with my mother, because she was a theater teacher and director in high school and quite a legend in my hometown. So she died 8 years ago, and I started feeling like I needed to summon up her youthful self and find out some things about her. And I started looking into this, and I found a number of her friends who were still alive, and I started meeting with them and looking for some kind of factual background for where she had been and what she'd done. And it was not an easy search, and the reason being that the records on this program were lost.
It was kind of a sweet story when you were interested in learning more about it, but the idea of writing an actual book about it didn't occur to you naturally.
No, I met a woman on a bus and who said that I needed to write this book. She had just come from a conference called Think Purple. Maybe it wasn't called that, but it was all over her T-shirt. And she said that it was about linking up women with aeronautical engineering degrees with potential employers. And when she heard what my mother had done, and I knew almost nothing at the time, she said, well, you're going to write a book about that. And I said, oh, I don't think so. And I wound up going to a play on Broadway, 2 days later, all about World War II manufacturing of airplane parts, and it was right back in the same territory. It was like, this path is laying open
for
me
now. The universe was speaking to you.
It was definitely speaking, grabbing me by the shirt tails, yeah.
It's a very interesting history. It's a wonderful nugget. At the very least, you could call it a nugget, but it was not easy to mine the nugget.
No, and I've contacted aviation history writers and museums and archivists and the National Archives records, government program records from the World War II. And those are kind of a mess because they're divided unevenly. Part of the war is in one location, the other half is in the other. And all of this happened at a very strange divide in the records. And so I was dashing back and forth between the National Archives in one location and in the other, and they all kept saying, no, no, it's at the other place. Oh, no, no, it's at the other place. So,
like the telephone company. So,
yeah.
But when you found them, were they, tell us about what you found eventually.
I never did find what I was really looking for in those archives. But I did find some other things in university archives. They were trained at seven universities, and a few of them have kept the records in a pretty orderly fashion, especially University of Minnesota and Iowa State. One program lost the folder. I mean, one university. They just found it again recently. So I'm happy about that.
But Curtis Wright?
Curtis Wright says they had a flood. So they disclaim any factual knowledge of how they ran the program.
Actually, when I was reading the book, someone said to you from Curtis Wright, we don't know what you're – that's not
right.
Our Curtis Wright.
Right, we don't know who
you're talking
about.
You don't know who you're talking about. Read a section from your book where you talk about what actually did happen with the records.
Well, it's called Otto the Octogenarian Dancer. an informant I spoke with in Columbus, 88-year-old Otto Acker, the engineer who put to rest a story about a buried SB2C, that was the plane they worked on, that it had been buried out back of one of the buildings. Otto worked at Curtiss Wright all through the war and had been recommended by at least three different aviation buffs as a man who'd been in the thick of it and was still quite sharp. I called Otto twice and asked him to come to our cadet party. When he finally returned, it was 11 o'clock on the night before the big to-do, and he told me he'd just come in from dancing at Schmidt's, a famous sausage house and microbrewery in German Village. During our interview, he told me he had worked closely with one cadet in the wing and fuselage section at Curtiss Wright and knew two or three others. He couldn't remember her name, but she had continued working there even after North American assumed control. Then he told me a story that made it hard for me to sleep. In 1945, while the Curtiss Wright Airplane Division was regrouping and consolidating its manufacturing and engineering at the Columbus plant, Otto left the company to work for Goodyear. In late 1950, as the airplane division was closing down, he stopped by the plant to say goodbye to his old co-workers. I found them shoveling boxes and boxes of stuff out the back door of the plant into a big dump truck. They were all real happy to see me and told me to just climb up and take my pick. Said I could have whatever I wanted, photos, drawings, company reports, but it was just too big a pile. I felt sick seeing how much good stuff they were throwing away. Years later, I could have kicked myself for not jumping in and trying to salvage some of it.
It was the records of the cadets.
Well, you know, it's hard to say because the cadet program was run in Buffalo, and when the company was shrinking down because of the problems they were having, they brought their records to Columbus. but not necessarily the cadet records. It's hard to say. A lot of stuff went into those dump trucks, but those might still be elsewhere. In fact, on this book tour, I'm going to be making a stop in upstate New York near Geneva, where the man who ran the program lived his last years because he was writing a book, and I'm still hoping to find something.
My guest is John V. Lenthy. She is the author of Flying Into Yesterday, My Search for the Curtiss Wright Aeronautical Engineering Cadets. It's about 900 women who were trained as engineers during World War II to take over for the men who had gone to war. If you have a question or comment for Jean V, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, frankly, I'd only vaguely heard of Curtiss Wright before. It doesn't really exist anymore. It's been bought out.
And no, it does exist.
It does. Okay, so vaguely, but I'm not real big into aeronautical engineering, obviously.
And neither are they really now.
Okay, I feel better. Yeah. But tell us about Curtiss Wright back during World War II and what they did, what they engineered.
Well, they became the biggest airplane manufacturer, including airframes, propellers, and engines in the United States. And they had a lot of government contracts, and they had a big presence in Buffalo. Then they had one in St. Louis, and they had an engine plant in Lockland near Cincinnati, and another huge one in New Jersey in Woodridge. Their propeller plant was in Caldwell, New Jersey as well. And by the end of the war, they were employing, 180,000 people. When they came to Columbus in 1941, it was a midway point between St. Louis and Buffalo, easy for parts to get around. So they built themselves a 1.2 million square foot plant here out on at 4300 East 5th, which is now Schottenstein's Property Group headquarters and showrooms. And so they had a lot of contract money, and they decided to ask for a little more because all the engineers were gone to war to train women. They got $2 million, which was a lot of money at the time. And then they did a very fast recruitment. They got instantaneous approval. They put the money to work really fast, and they got these women up and running and studying within 5 months. And they had gone all over the country to recruit them. 3,000 interviews. And so they started the program and ran it in 1943, and the women were there and on the premises working by 1944.
One of the folks who reviewed the book, George Palmer, he's professor emeritus of aeronautical engineering at Purdue University. He writes, as a senior in aeronautical engineering at Purdue, I taught aerodynamics to the cadet class of 1944. A few faculty members absolutely refused to teach girls, but I found that among the cadets, there was a normal distribution of those just getting by and those who were so capable at complex engineering details they could have pursued careers as graduate engineers. What do you know about overall about who they recruited and how they did it?
They went to all the schools they could find in the Midwest and the East.
Schools being high schools?
Universities, okay. Yeah. These women were already at least sophomores, sometimes juniors, and they had to be in the top half of the class and the top third in mathematics, and they had to have at least a year of college math. And they didn't allow them to study at the same campuses where they were recruited. They wanted to pull them out and make them theirs and really get them to focus. So Peggy, for instance, she was in Arkansas, and she went to Purdue. And Nova was from Columbus, and she went to Purdue.
I'll be introducing Peggy and Nova coming up in the next segment. Go ahead.
Yep. So they were all pulled out of wherever they were. My mother was studying at University of Texas. And I thought it was a nice bit of escape for her out of Texas that she got to go up there. And
Do you think that's why she did it?
I do. Yeah. Okay. Down deep, I think she just wanted to get out of Texas.
Mm-hmm. So, but what were they looking for? I mean, doesn't that kind of leave those are pretty broad specs when you're talking about recruiting.
Well, they were looking for women who had a lot of smarts in math and were doing pretty well scholastically overall. And they didn't do very long interviews. It was about 15 minutes. But they came out pretty well, really. Out of the 918, they actually recruited 766, made the grade, and showed up and worked in the plants. And they didn't even have contracts. They didn't have to. But they showed up and loyally came to work. And they were doing everything in the plants that, say, assistant or junior grade engineers could do. And some of them were in research. Some of them did inspections. A great many of them were at the drafting tables, translating engineering orders and changes into really beautiful drawings so that they could be fabricated back in the fabrication departments and make the planes. And I would say that without them, the whole war would have dragged on longer. They really made a difference.
Were other companies doing similar kinds of recruiting
operations? Not with aeronautical engineering. Some of them, RCA recruited, and they did a bunch of training on the same campus as some of these, Purdue, in electrical engineering. And women were being given some training in some of the plants, but this kind of intensive 10 months of training, they worked them so hard. They had this joke that if you dropped a pencil, you lean over to pick it up, you missed a whole course in algebra.
Well, it was 10 months of training to encompass how many years of engineering school?
The University of Minnesota stated that it was about the equivalent of 2.5 years of the upper division engineering curriculum in 10 months. That's a lot. So
it is a lot. My guest is John V. Lenthy. She is the author of Flying Into Yesterday, My Search for the Curtis Wright Aeronautical Engineering Cadets. Coming up, we're going to meet a couple of those cadets. They're with us right now. If you have a question or comment for them, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. And you can listen to our station anytime by streaming on the web. Just visit WOSU.org and click on the Listen Now button at the top of the page. Listen to local and national news from your computer or mobile device. Just visit WOSU.org.
Support for 89.7 comes from Capital University, presenting Art Spiegelman, Pulitzer Prize-winning artist, illustrator, and author of Mouse, Thursday evening, October 27th at Mace Hall. The lecture is open to the public. More at capital.edu.
58 degrees with cloudy skies in downtown Columbus, showers and maybe a thunderstorm possible today, a high of 67 degrees. Rain is likely tonight, a low of 46 degrees, more rain for Thursday, and a high of 49. Clouds Thursday night, a low of 35, and sunshine as we look ahead to Friday, a high of 52. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Today on All Sides, we're talking about women engineers in the United States and a lost chapter of World War II history, the Curtis Wright Cadets, 365 of whom worked at a Curtis Wright airplane plant right here in Columbus. Later on, we'll talk with the president and CEO of the Society of Women Engineers about the challenges facing women engineers today. Still with us is John V. Lenthy. She's the author of Flying Into Yesterday, My Search for the Curtiss-Wright Aeronautical Engineering Cadets. John V., once again, thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure.
Joining us now are two former Curtiss-Wright cadets. Nova Anderson Weller is an Ohio native who was trained in the Curtiss-Wright Cadet Program at Purdue University in Indiana from October 1944 through March 1945. She helped redesign the instrument panel in the SB-2C Helldiver at the Curtiss-Wright plant in Columbus. Nova, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Also with us is Margaret Upham. Peggy is a Texas native who trained in the Curtiss-Wright Cadet Program at Purdue University in 1943, and she worked as a mechanical engineering draftsperson, also at the Curtiss-Wright plant in Columbus. Welcome to the show, Peggy.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Peggy, where were you recruited, and how did you find out about this? How did you get in this gig?
I was in a small college up in Central Arkansas, and the dean called me into his office one day, and I thought, oh gosh, what have I done? And so he announced it and told me about this program, and he had talked to my parents even. He'd called them, and he thought that this might be good for me to do.
How old were you at the time?
Oh gosh, I was a sophomore in college, so I was 18, 19 years old. It was a good chance for me to have additional college, and I was enjoying my science and math at the time. And from there, then, as I said, they had already talked to my parents, and my parents agreed this was good for me to do.
Had you had a career in engineering or a math and science-related career occurred to you before then?
No, I had just liked math and science from high school days. Mm-hmm. But my science was chemistry in those years, but the math, all phases of math, that I really enjoyed.
But when you graduated from college, what were your original plans?
When I did not graduate from college, and shall I go back to World War II?
Well, okay. Before Curtiss-Wright came to you.
Before I was just a sophomore.
Right. What were your plans, though, after college?
Then I would want to get into costume design.
Okay.
And, of course, World War II started, and that was the end of that.
I didn't know
so
that.
So I had to change plans, yeah. Yes.
Kind of like your mom going into the theater, right?
Right.
Who'd have thunk? Nova, what about you? How did they find you and recruit you?
Well, I was taking a course down at Central High School, the summer course here in Columbus.
In Columbus, right.
Yes. I took 2 years down there in the summer to graduate early from high school. So I was in a physics class, and the teacher came up to me and said, there's an interesting article on the bulletin board. You ought to read it. So I went down, and it was the offer of Curtiss-Wright cadets. So I took it and got connected with them, and they accepted me. I don't even remember having an interview. I think by then they were desperate for women. I had not graduated from high school yet.
Well,
I was the last group, and so they were running out of.
Jean V, was it that hard to find people qualified to do this at the time?
To take the training?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know. They still needed them, but there weren't as many training universities involved anymore. It all shrank down just to Purdue.
To find the people, to find the young women qualified mm-hmm. to do this, there had to be a million young women out there who were good in math and science.
Well, I think maybe the money for all the recruiting had kind of gone away,
okay.
too. They had to take whomever they could find quickly.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I think they were getting desperate by then.
So how did you find the training? What was it like, Peggy?
The training took an awful lot of study, a lot of hours, but I found it quite interesting, and I think most of the professors, though we were the first women in their classes, I thought they were very helpful to us. And I enjoyed it and looked forward to each day in the different classes and what I was learning in each class that we were taking.
You too, Novi. Did you enjoy it? Or
yes, I liked it very much.
Because it said some of them didn't necessarily make it
right
all the way through.
But I think I was more technically minded to begin with, and I was interested in airplanes to begin with. I had taken some flying lessons when I was about 14, so I knew something about the airplane. And so I think maybe that's how they decided to take me.
What kind of promises did they make you about post-war opportunity with Curtis Wright?
I never heard any promises.
Did you expect anything after the war?
No, I didn't.
What about you, Peggy?
No, same thing. No promises. And I think we were all, most of us, ready to finish that. And we knew this ahead of time. At the end of the war, that was it. And so then we could get back to our own respective colleges and towns and so forth.
There were laws, right, that...
The returning vets got to have their jobs back. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Yeah. But they did have brochures that initially attracted these women that promised them equal opportunity at the end of the war in the company.
But that's not something that you felt...
That they were serious about.
That wasn't really why you did it.
No.
So was there any benefit to you in doing it, Nova?
Oh, yes. I felt like I got a lot out of it. Well, I saved a couple of, well, at least a year of credit for when I went back to college.
And you finished college?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Did it affect your work or your career path?
Yes.
How so?
Well, I went back to college and took horticulture because by then engineers were a dime a dozen because the ones who were coming back from the war wanted their jobs back, and there were no engineering jobs, especially hardly. And so I took horticulture and worked in that for about a year and in California, and came back to Columbus then and decided that engineering paid better than horticulture did. And I got a job at Battelle. So I went back and worked as an engineer at Battelle.
What about you, Peggy?
Well, at the end of World War II, when I came back to Dallas, there was no need for women engineers, like you say. And so I had to capitalize on whatever I could do. And the mechanical drawing was the thing that started me back into work. And from there, then, mine evolved into, the time I started, it became very interested in the exploration part of the petroleum industry. And from there, I went on all the way through my years working with geologists and geophysicists, and later doing all their illustrations and brochures or whatever for seminars and for other meetings, and then for education purposes as well.
Would you have, it's always a what if, you never know, but without the Curtis Wright experience, would you have just gone back to your dream of fashion design and that sort of thing,
probably,
do you think?
Probably so.
But
who knows, you say, yeah.
Whoever knows, there was a war going on.
That's right. End of a war, yes.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the Curtis Wright cadets. They were trained in a matter of months to do what others were trained over a course of years to perform engineering jobs for the Curtis Wright plane company. They worked until the end of World War II, and then they were dismissed. Joining me in the studio is John V. Lenthy. She's the author of Flying Into Yesterday, My Search for the Curtis Wright Aeronautical Engineering Cadets, and also two of those cadets, Margaret Upham. She was a Curtis Wright cadet in Columbus until the end of World War II, and also Nova Anderson Weller, as well a Curtis Wright cadet in Columbus until the end of World War II. If you have a question or comment for them, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We were talking to John V. about the fact that her mother really never talked about it a lot. And I was wondering if either of you thought about it as something significant in your life. You can look back and see the significance, but at the time, did it feel significant, Peggy? Is it something you told people about?
To a point, yes. But I think that at that time, everybody was so busy doing whatever they could. And so it didn't, in a way, possibly mean as much to me as it did in later years, whereby I used that education, yes.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Nova?
I don't think it. I don't know.
when you had children?
Yes. Well, I went to Patel and got married mm-hmm. then, and I married an engineer.
Okay.
And then I had three children.
And would you tell them about back in the days when I was a Curtis Wright cadet?
My daughter was interested in that. Uh-huh. And actually, all three of our children became engineers. So my daughter was an electrical, and another boy was electrical, and one was a mechanical engineer.
They've had reunions of the cadets, right?
Right.
Those sounds like those are pretty good parties. That's something, John V, that your mother always managed to get away to, right?
She almost all of them, yeah. Mm-hmm. They had them every few years, starting in the 80s, I guess, when their kids were pretty much grown.
In college.
Yeah, right.
So when you get back to and meet the people, what's it like? What do you talk about? Peggy?
I would say that the many good times and our memories and our rehash some of the funnies that happened when we were both at Purdue and in Columbus here, right. Yes.
And this is her first time back here since the war.
Yeah.
And yesterday we found the house that she lived in with the
Things
five
have
other
changed,
women.
Huh?
Right on Main Street we found it.
Did you feel discrimination? Did you feel like, I read the comments from the Purdue a professor who said he taught with men who didn't want to teach the cadets.
No, I never felt discriminated. I guess I just always, I just didn't never, just never had that feeling at all.
Yeah?
All right.
Peggy?
No, I didn't. As I said earlier, that to me, I think they were very helpful, and some of them more almost like a fatherly attitude toward us to help us. And so I felt, I didn't feel discriminated at all.
If you want to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page, and you can tweet me at Ann Fisher WOSU. And Linda in Pataskala, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Linda.
Hi.
Hey.
I was really interested in your show.
Thanks.
I was wondering, you were talking about that there was a hard time finding women that were really smart to be able to go in this program.
Yeah, it sounded like they were having a hard time finding enough.
Yeah, well, probably even the really, really smart women probably had families and children and didn't know about this program. I'm a retired electrician, and I started in the 80s, and it was just by chance that I got introduced to a program. And I think that probably the ignorance of not letting women know what was going on in those days is probably what contributed to that.
Yeah, it sounds like they targeted mostly young women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, college age, yeah. Mm-hmm. They didn't go after anyone who was married or had kids at the time.
Yeah, my family didn't even mention college back, when I was growing up. So we didn't even have the opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a lot of these women said they would not have had college opportunities without this program. They were very grateful for that.
Well, thanks, Linda.
Thank you.
Take care. If you want to give us a call, 614-292-8513. Well, I guess Peggy and Nova, it inspires the question, what would you like young women growing up today to know about your history and what it could mean for their own futures?
I would say for we women, I think women can do anything they set their heads to do. And I think today's world, we're gradually getting more and more where women are respected in many, many professions. And I see it quite often, yes.
Nova?
I agree with Peggy, totally. I think that the women are more respected now because they have broken into the field. And they do realize that they can do things that they didn't think they could before.
I was looking at a little bit of background, and the women are still earning a fraction of what men make. There's the numbers are kind of old that we had. They were 2001, but the number of women, I think it was 20% of the engineers or the graduates from engineering schools were women. 11% are women in the engineering field still. Are you surprised by that?
Well, yes and no. I think that it depends. I don't know. I think there are a lot of women that probably just don't realize that they could get into that field.
They still have an image of men being the engineers.
Yeah, right. Uh-huh.
So this is helpful to let them know that something this sophisticated was done during the war by women.
Right.
And the kinds of jobs they were doing in that plant were very important. They were life and death jobs to the, you know, the pilots who flew those planes. In particular, this plane, the Helldiver, was a very difficult plane. They had so many changes to make to it to make it work. But it was also a plane that helped finish the war. And it could cross greater distances and carry more bombs. And they worked on all parts of that plane. So, you know, we owe them a lot for what they did in that war.
There is a song about the cadets. Yeah. Was it written back then?
Yeah, it was written with a little bit of apprehension about the name Curtis Wright, the company. They were a big mega company, but... The song is from the book. It says, "Don't send my girl to Lockheed," the dying mother said. "Don't send her to Consolidated. I'd rather see her dead. But send my girl to Douglas, or better still, to Bell. And as for dear old Curtis Wright, I'd see her first in hell." There were some issues about this company.
Biff, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Biff. Hello, Biff. Okay. Biff, we're trying to get you on the phone. You might be listening to the television. You need to turn it off. I'll try one more time. Biff, are you there? No. Biff, are you there now? Okay. Well, we'll just turn it off. Sorry about that, Biff, but we could not get you on the phone, so maybe better luck next time. I want to thank my guests now for joining us today. Nova Anderson Weller, she was a Curtis Wright cadet in Columbus until the end of World War II. Thanks for joining us, Nova.
Appreciate it. Nice to be here.
And also Margaret Upham, Peggy, Curtis Wright cadet in Columbus until the end of World War II. It's her first time back in Columbus since those days at Curtis Wright. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
And also John V. Lenthy, author of Flying Into Yesterday, My Search for the Curtis Wright Aeronautical Engineering Cadets. Thanks a lot for joining us today, John V.
No, you're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Appreciate it. Coming up, Betty Shanahan. She's the executive director and CEO of the Society of Women Engineers. We will talk with her when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Herman Cain hangs in at the top of the polls. We'll look at Mr. 999, his life, his politics, and where he's headed. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point begins this afternoon at 1 o'clock on 89.7 NPR News. Stay right here in 20 minutes, beginning at 11 for Hour 2 of All Sides, and special coverage of the November 8th election, the Columbus mayor's race. Joining us for the show will be Republican candidate Earl Smith and Democratic candidate Mayor Michael Coleman. Join us for Hour 2 of All Sides at 11.
Support for 89.7 comes from the private banking team at Huntington Bank, where tailored financial advice is delivered by a team of wealth professionals person to person. Listen, plan, advise. Information at huntington.com/wealthadvisors.
And this is 89.7 NPR News, and our fall membership drive was a great success, thanks to your generous contributions. Thank you for investing in the quality programming on 89.7 NPR News. Rain is possible today, a high of 67 degrees. Rain is likely, heavy rain at times tonight, a low of 46. Showers expected on Thursday, and a high of 49. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We've been talking about the lost history of the Curtiss Wright cadets, women engineers in World War II who were specially trained to replace male engineers during the war, but mostly lost their jobs and careers in aeronautical engineering after the war. At the end of the first decade of the 21st century, American women continue to be underrepresented in the field of engineering. Joining us now is Betty Shanahan. She's the executive director and CEO for the Society of Women Engineers. It's a 19,000-member organization founded in 1950. When she became the Society of Women Engineers Executive Director in September 2002, Betty became the first engineer to hold this position. In 2010, she was the first woman to receive the Claude R. Erickson Distinguished Alumnus Award from the College of Engineering at Michigan State University. Welcome to a fellow Spartan, Betty Shanahan.
Go green, Ann.
Go green. It's a good year for us, isn't it?
It is, but I don't know if some of your listening audience in Columbus is going to appreciate that.
Well, they don't usually when I bring it up, but what the heck.
That's some of the fun. That's some of the fun of the big tech.
The purpose of the Society of Women Engineers is to establish engineering as a desirable career aspiration for women and to empower them to succeed as engineers and as leaders. So how is the work? What does the organization do to meet those goals? Because they, when you look at the statistics, they seem ominous.
Yeah, and there's two main things that we do, and we use the tagline of Aspire, Advance, Achieve. Aspire is reaching out to girls, and that's why I think your program today is very exciting, is for any of the listening audience to realize that engineering, even during World War II or today, is a very exciting career for women. One of the cadets was talking about how much she enjoyed it. You can make a real difference in the world. You can have fun work that really is essential to the health, happiness, and safety of people in this country and around the world. So we try and get that message to girls that although it is male-dominated, it's a wonderful career. And then when we look at the rest of the tagline, Advance and Achieve, it's really supporting women in their careers throughout their college years and through the profession and into retirement and recognizing them for their contributions as engineers and as leaders. And a lot of the challenges supporting women through their careers are some of the biases that the cadets experienced still subtly exist today. The expectation that engineering is a man's job, that it's not an appropriate job for women, that women don't, as one of the cadets said, women don't know that they can get into this field. And sadly today, that's true. Girls don't realize it, their teachers don't realize it, and their parents don't realize it.
Well, when you look at the statistics about their earnings, though, it's it has to be discouraging if you're looking to get into the field and you're spending the money on a college degree and you're making by 15 to 19 or 20 years after graduation some $10,000 less than your male counterparts.
Yeah, there continues to be a disparity between earnings for women in engineering and the men in engineering. But we actually have a little smaller gap than a lot of the other professions. So I think what I'd like to do is encourage women to look at some of their earning potential in general compared to many other fields, especially when you look at considered careers where you only require a four-year degree.
And of course, a lot of these statistics look at their averages, and they don't, and because so few women are in upper management, that will skew things as well, won't it?
Yeah, and I think the engineering profession as a whole has the earnings data skewed because when engineers move into some of these top ranks, they're no longer considered engineers. Now they're categorized as business people. So when you look at top executives in companies, and in so many companies, especially technical companies, those come from the engineering ranks. That average earning over a lifetime is now included as a business major or a business person, not an engineer.
My guest is Betty Shanahan. She's executive director and CEO of the Society of Women Engineers. If you have a question or comment for her, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'd love to hear from our listeners out there who are female and engineers and talk about what your success or not has been in the field of engineering. 614-292-8513 is the number to call, and you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. we've been talking about the lost history of the Curtis Wright cadets, Betty, as you know, and I was wondering how many other women like that are out there. We were talking about did other companies recruit? What do we know about the history of women engineers during World War II in a broader way?
I think, you know, first of all, the book that's coming out is very exciting, and our organization just celebrated its 60th anniversary last year, and we compiled a journal looking at some of our history and focused on the Curtis Wright cadets and the World War II time also within that journal. We don't have, to my knowledge, the same depth of research that is there for the Curtis Wright cadets, because fortunately, although certainly a lot of the history was lost, fortunately a lot of it still is retained in some of the archives of the schools that trained the cadets. But their story is not an unusual story, and I can tell you anecdotally just from my experience in the society. We had an opportunity in the 80s in Boston, Society of Women Engineers, to bring back some of our presidents, and a few of them had served as engineers during the war. They had their engineering degrees, and when the war ended, the returning soldiers got jobs. So the women who were working as engineers and completely trained as engineers stepped down into technician roles and had to sort of restart their career from a technician position.
When we were talking to Peggy Upham and Nova Weller, it sounds like they parlayed their experiences into pretty great careers, but not necessarily what they were doing for Curtis Wright. There weren't a lot of jobs like that after the war anyways, right? I mean, they weren't building planes like they were anymore.
No, but engineers, you know, participate throughout the entire infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the time after the war, certainly that was the boom of infrastructure in this country and a lot of construction projects.
So one article about women engineers refers to the leaky pipeline theory of gender parity in the sciences, and it postulates that women drop out of science programs at every level of education. So there's this a big drop-off all the way down the line, and when you get to the top levels and when you get to the very experienced levels, there just aren't as many there because they're dropping off all along the way.
Yes, that leaky pipeline, we'd certainly like to change into a highway with many entrances. But I think right now it's probably a pretty apt analogy. One of the traditional thoughts was that girls don't consider careers in engineering because they don't have the math and science background in high school. And that's no longer the case. There's been a lot of progress in recent years, and girls are taking advanced math and science in high school at close to the same rates as boys. But they're still not choosing to major in engineering at anything close to those same rates. And so why are the girls leaking out of the pipeline there? Well, there's actually, if your readers want or your listeners want to do a little more research, there's an extremely readable report the American Association of University Women did called Why So Few. And it talks about the societal environmental factors that shape girls' achievements and interests in math and science. And it really looks at a lot of the social science that's out there that and turns it into something that's understandable by a layperson. And all the messages that we give girls, the messages that the profession gives teachers in terms of what is this field about, you're giving messages that it's very hard but stick to it, as opposed to what motivates girls about a career. You get to work with people, you solve exciting problems, you make a difference, you make a good living. And then that pipeline that continues to leak, once girls enter their engineering programs, they're going to drop out at higher rates than men, and they're going to drop out with higher average grades than men. And very often...
So it's not the academic, the challenge that's driving them out.
No, it's not. It's very much tied to climate. And I see right now a movement amongst a number of the engineering deans and administrators in engineering departments to really try and say, how do we change the climate to retain more of the young women and retain more of the young men, too, because of a very meaningful percentage of men drop out of their programs. And as a country, we have a demand for more engineers. We need engineers for innovation, and we get young people interested enough to start a program, we need them to continue the program. So there's efforts in everything from changing the climate in engineering colleges to having some of the early classes that engineering students take be much more about what engineering is, so that you can see, the student can see the value of engineering rather than seeing only the foundational math and science and take years to actually get into the real engineering classes.
To what extent is the turnoff the fact that when they, even when they go to do internships or they go to visit companies, you know, engineering firms, wherever they go to see where engineers do their work, they walk in the room and they don't see anyone who really looks a lot like them?
That's the challenge, you know, throughout the career. You're an engineering student, you see very few professors that look like you. You walk into industry, most of the people you work with don't like look like you. You look up above you in management, you see few that look like you. And some of that is a matter of building the pipeline, getting more women. And some of it is really building an awareness in industry, you know, with the employers, and within the engineering schools of what it really means to create an inclusive environment. Fortunately, today, we don't experience, you know, or rarely experience, I think, some of the situations that the Curtis Wright cadets faced. But there's still a lot of unconscious bias in the workplace. All people carry these biases. And for anyone that's in a minority situation, and in engineering, it's not just girls, it's people of color, gays and lesbians, they're all severely underrepresented in engineering. So how do you create that really inclusive environment when you're in a majority situation? And some of it's really starting to understand how to authentically include people of different backgrounds and cultures. And this isn't important just to for the numbers of women in engineering. This is also important because diversity gives better innovation, and engineering is a very creative profession.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what difference does it make that women aren't there? What are we missing out on? How do you prove a negative?
Well, there's research that actually talks about how more diverse teams give better solutions, create more innovative solutions. And a researcher out of University of Michigan, Scott Page, is an economist and has documented the economic value of diversity, and able to show that a more diverse teams will take a little longer to get clicking and working productively together. But once they do, their creativity and innovation will far surpass a homogeneous team. So when you have a very creative profession like engineering, it's important to have all these different perspectives so that the best products come out, the best solutions come out. When you look at the challenges that our planet is facing, you know, everything from delivering clean water to climate change to entertainment, so it's going to be engineers that are going to solve these problems, and we really need some creative solutions, which means we really need not just diversity in the sense of different people there, but diversity in that people can bring their authentic self to work every day, bring their different perspectives, and have those welcomed so that the best ideas come out.
There's the Society of Women Engineers. Obviously, there's a larger Society of Engineers. There's Society of African-American Engineers. Or they're all different kinds of societies out there. To what extent does that separation of those societies contribute or not to the separation, you know, and the lack of women and other diverse groups in engineering?
We kind of divide and maybe divide and conquer the problem, but the individual organizations work very, very closely together.
Okay.
all the time. So the National Society of Black Engineers, the Society of Hispanic Professional Engineers, American Indian Science Engineering Society, and ourselves are working very much on a grant we have funded from the National Science Foundation on how to create inclusive outreach for girls. The major engineering societies partner with us all the time. We actually just joined with the American Society of Mechanical Engineers on a program called Engineering for Change, which is bringing an online platform to help engineers contribute solutions to problems in communities around the globe that don't have access to engineering talent but have some real engineering problems. That could be as simple as, you know, how do I fix my pump? And so it's in partnership with what I could call the discipline-focused societies that we're able to address some of the technical issues. So I would say, rather than being a lot of independent societies, we're actually societies that partner frequently, bringing our own piece of expertise into the bigger solution.
Is there a goal out there that you're shooting for in terms of women in engineering?
No, we haven't expressed a goal. I would say that I think if I could give a personal goal, mm-hmm. it would be that any young woman considers engineering as a profession like she might consider a medical profession or teaching profession or a business profession. And at that point, if the young woman makes a career choice that is different because of her interest, that's great. But I would love to see that the option is there, that every girl is able to give it the same kind of consideration she does most other careers, because it's a great opportunity. And I think once a young woman is engaged, the opportunities in the field are almost endless.
Betty Shanahan, thanks for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Okay, thank you, Ann. I appreciate you bringing this important topic and the Curtis Wright Cadets on the air.
Betty Shanahan, she's Executive Director and CEO of the Society of Women Engineers. There's a book out about the Curtis Wright Aeronautical Engineering Cadets. It's called Flying Into Yesterday, My Search for the Curtis Wright Aeronautical Engineering Cadets by John V. Lenthy. There will be a book signing. You can learn more about it by going to our website at wosu.org. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.